A warning before we begin, this episode is not suitable for children, work, or anyone uncomfortable with the concept of pornography. I won't get too graphic, but there are some rather large aspects of this story that simply cannot be ignored. Or rather, they cannot be ignored by me specifically because the opportunity for jokes is too good to pass up. How do you solve a riddle when the clues all contradict each other? When so many different versions of a story exist, how do you sort through them in search of the truth? How do we get justice for the victims of a horrific crime when no one's story matches up? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I always thought the Wonderland murders were somehow connected to the Manson murders. I guess it was because of the time period and proximity of both sets of awful tragedies that the two were linked in my mind. Though, in truth, there was more than a decade between the events, in my mind, they were lumped into some nebulous era of drugs and chaos in Los Angeles. Turns out, the two sets of murders had almost nothing to do with each other. The only things they had in common, it seems, were the Hollywood Hills, a disillusionment with conventional society, and drugs. Today's real-life story picks up where the fictionalized prelude to it leaves off. Boogie Nights, the 1997 Paul Thomas Anderson movie starring every A-list actor who ever existed. For those of you who never saw Boogie Nights, let me sum up. It's loosely based on John Holmes' career as a porn actor, with everyone's name changed. By the end, Mark Wahlberg's character Dirk Diggler, the John Holmes character of the movie, has become such a massive drug addict that he's lost work, just like the real Holmes. He's offered a chance to come back, and the movie ends with him willing his willy to stand at attention so he can perform again. But what happened after the real-life Dirk Diggler, aka John Holmes, couldn't make his wang work anymore, is truly the stuff of nightmares. Today, we'll take a trip into the seedy underbelly of 1970s Los Angeles, California, where Hollywood was awash in cash thanks to the burgeoning independent movie wave, during which movies were made for cheap and raked in millions at the box office, where a young, displaced immigrant from Palestine could scratch his way to the top, starting out as a humble hot dog vendor and eventually owning multiple nightclubs and being one of the go-to drug dealers of the town. And boy, were there a lot of drugs. One publicist told the LA Times in 1978 that cocaine was, quote, the ambrosia of the gods. That same article claimed a movie star whose movie was shooting on location in Europe, quote, only agreed to do the film after being reassured that his weekly supply of cocaine, 7 grams, would be brought to him, end quote. And for some reason, Kim Basinger got shit for requesting Evian to wash her hair. Anyway, there was a lot of money, a lot of drugs, and a lot of body hair on display in the exploding porn industry. And when you put all these things in the hands of folks making their living off illegal entertainment and splitting snow with, it seems, anyone on set, bad things are bound to happen. I looked up one of the main characters of today's story and found not one, but 2 YouTube videos about him that were narrated by AI, so I refused to watch them. Then I learned about the so-called documentary called Exhausted, John C. Holmes, The Real Story. So I looked that up, and it turned out to be literally just a hardcore porno with interviews. I mean, I get it. It's his body of work, but I don't need to see his body at work for the purposes of this story. So, let's just rewind a bit. John Holmes' origin story is a bit nebulous. He claimed to have been raised in New York City by a wealthy aunt, which sounds suspiciously like the plot of Auntie Mame. He said he lost his virginity at age 6 to a Swiss maid. According to an incredibly thorough piece about this whole saga by Julia Shears on Crime Library, Holmes told interviewers he had degrees in physical therapy, medicine, and political science from UCLA, and that he'd written a series of children's books. He also boasted that he'd slept with two governors' wives and, more scandalously, three governors. I'm not sure, in the whole slew of coverage on this man, if anyone tried to verify any of these stories or if they just took it on faith. I'm sure he would have claimed he'd done all these things under a different name anyway. And it's not like any governor would be like, oh yeah, I totally bottomed for that guy. I should note here that the piece by Shears on Crime Library is so thorough that I used it as my main source for this episode. The piece even includes an extensive bibliography. However, for some reason I had trouble accessing some of their sources myself, so I am relying heavily on the Crime Library reporting for this episode. So Shears also reported that Holmes, quote, told others the truth, that he was born August 8, 1944, in a backwater Ohio town, where he was raised by his devoutly Christian mother and a violent, boozy stepfather. That at age 16, he dropped out of school to join the army and was stationed in West Germany for several years before moving to Los Angeles, where he found his true calling, making dirty movies with his monstrous penis, end quote. Speaking of his monstrous penis, Holmes' wife, Sharon, reportedly came home early from work one day to find John measuring his own manhood. When she was like, "Excuse me, what are you doing?" he confessed he'd already posed nude for some magazine spreads and done some film loops. I don't know what a film loop is in this context, but I can only imagine it meant just a loop of one particular sex act over and over. Later, when asked how he broke into the porn industry, he gave conflicting accounts. In one version, he said a nudie photographer noticed John's Johnson while he was peeing at a urinal and suggested he pose for him. In another version, he had a neighbor who was making porn and told him he'd make a great living in porn. How she came to see his member, I don't know. However it happened, his wife Sharon was appalled. She told LA Magazine in 2003, quote, "He told me that this was going to be his life's work, that this was going to make him famous. I looked at him like, what planet do you come from?" The couple had met in 64 when he was an ambulance driver and she was a nurse at County USC Hospital, now Los Angeles General Medical Center. The couple had only been married a few years by that point, but as Crime Library reports, quote, "From the moment she caught her husband measuring his manhood, there was a fundamental shift in their relationship. Although they retained the outward trappings of a normal marriage, sharing meals and household chores, Sharon never welcomed John into the conjugal bed again," end quote. This is an odd choice to me. Perhaps it's because in California, as in most of the country at that time, the person seeking a divorce had to prove adultery, abuse, or other misconduct. It wasn't until 1969 that someone could divorce on the grounds of, "I can't fucking stand this fucking guy." And let me tell you, John Holmes was definitely a this fucking guy, in multiple senses of the phrase. Anyway, of course, this doesn't explain why Sharon stayed with John for as long as she did, but who knows what goes on inside a marriage. Maybe he promised her a lavish lifestyle with his porn money. Maybe she was Catholic. I don't know. But for some reason, despite being mortified by her husband's career choice, she chose to stay with him. This, even after he became a household name, thanks to his epic man rod. Soon, John met porn director Bob Chin, who apparently took one look at him and was like, "No thanks." But then Holmes pulled out his pony baloney and Chin was in. So in was he, in fact, that he went home that very night and invented Holmes' best-known character, Detective Johnny Wadd. Now, for you youngins who were brought up on modern-day porn, in which every scene is basically just one person walking into a room where there's another person and then they just start going at it, back in my day, pornos had plots. And in the Johnny Wadd series, Wadd went around solving crimes and doing everyone along the way. The sex was incidental. And listen, not to get too personal here, but I far prefer plot-driven porn. I want to know why these people are fucking. And if a bad guy gets nailed in the process, all the better. I may be the only person in history who didn't fast-forward through the non-sex scenes. Indeed, I probably rewound if it seemed I'd missed an important plot point. The 1970s wasn't just the golden age of gritty Hollywood. Some might say it was the golden age of porn. It was an age where there were actual porn stars. These were household names, although most households would deny it. And to many, John Holmes was the first male porn star, whose life and times we'll sneakily press play on after the break. Strangers, this episode of Strange and Unexplained with Daisy Egan is brought to you by Alloy Health. We all know what getting older can do to our sex lives. Way too many women quietly accept it. But what you might not know is that perimenopause or menopause can be the reason why, and prescription help exists. My libido was in the toilet until I started on HRT. Now my husband has to hide from me just to get a break. Maybe that's TMI, but just because you're going through the change of life doesn't mean your sex life has to be dead. Alloy offers two prescription products to help solve both sides, desire and discomfort. Estradiol Vaginal Cream is a prescription treatment that restores moisture and reduces discomfort. 80% of women see improvement in vaginal symptoms within 4 to 12 weeks. And the O-mazing cream includes topical sildenafil, the same active ingredient as Viagra formulated for women, designed to increase blood flow and heighten sensation. Both are available individually or as a bundle with extra savings. You don't need an appointment or insurance, and you get a doctor who specializes in menopause. Complete your intake online, and Alloy matches you with a menopause-specialized physician who reviews your intake and prescribes what's right for you. Plus, you get $0 unlimited messaging with your doctor. Better sex delivered to your door. Once approved, your prescription ships straight to you. Discreet, fast, no pharmacy required. With Alloy's sexual health bundle, your best sex is still ahead. Visit myalloy.com and use the code STRANGE to get $20 off your first order. Your menopause-specialized doctor will tailor your care to your needs. Plus, you get $0 unlimited messaging with your doctor. Head to myalloy.com and use code STRANGE to get $20 off your first order. In the documentary about his life that is actually, as I mentioned, just a hardcore porn, Holmes claims to have slept with over 14,000 women between partners both on screen, he made over 2,000 films, and off, both paid and unpaid. He says he sat down one night and tried to count. The interviewer is like, "That must have taken you days." But he explains that the process went quickly because of his own special "how many women have I bedded" equation he came up with. According to Crime Library, he was quoted somewhere as saying, quote, 12 of these women, all married and with the approval of their husbands, are mothers of children I have sired, each for a large fee, end quote. He allegedly pulled in $3,000 a day making movies, and according to Crime Library, quote, at his nadir, he smoked away roughly the same amount in freebase cocaine, end quote. That's a lot of cocaine, folks. I can't even imagine what that kind of drug use does to a person's brain. Porn was definitely not an above-board industry, despite its popularity. Yet, somehow, even though porn production was illegal, there were nudie movie houses all over Times Square, and the movies were advertised in the newspapers. Indeed, doing a search for John Holmes in the Los Angeles Times is so frustrating because the bulk of the coverage on him is just ads for his movies. But hey, that's classic American capitalism, folks. What's illegal to do is all but allowed to sell. The market is a big gaping loophole, sorry. And still, this didn't exactly protect industry talent at the time as much as it did its money men at the top. And so, in 1973, Holmes was arrested while shooting a porno. I don't know the details about this arrest or if anyone else from the production was arrested, and what's most confusing is that even though it was illegal to make porn, Holmes wasn't arrested for making porn. He was arrested on charges of pimping and pandering, which is apparently the crime of compelling someone into prostitution. His wife Sharon either wouldn't or couldn't bail him out, so Holmes struck a deal with the LAPD in which he would offer them information about what was happening on porn sets, and they would not only release him, but leave him alone going forward. But being a freebasing porn actor and a snitch for the cops weren't the only seedy things Holmes engaged in. In 1976, Holmes and Sharon were managing an apartment complex in Glendale, a suburb of L.A., which is to say most likely Sharon was managing the apartment complex while Holmes was out using his hairy canary to make money and smoke crack. At any rate, 15-year-old Dawn Schiller was living at the apartment complex with her family. They were barely scraping by, and it seems Holmes used this as a way to get in Dawn's good graces. According to the LA Times, in a 2003 interview, Don said, quote, "We related on a really childlike level. I didn't know what business he was in. He'd do silly, cute, charming things around me. He liked my innocence, the fact that I had nothing to do with the porn industry," end quote. About his gargantuan one-eyed trouser snake, Don told the Beverly Hills Sun that he was shy about it and was scared she would be scared of it, but apparently not shy or scared enough to refrain from taking her and her little sister, who was 14 at the time, to a nudie picture house to see one of his films. According to Crime Library, quote, "At first he treated Schiller like a kid's sister, driving her to shopping malls and the beach. But then he became possessive, getting angry if she hung out with friends after school instead of coming straight home," end quote. He was possessive, apparently, even before he took her virginity at 15 in the back of his van. She told LA Weekly, quote, "At the time, he was very sincere. I was very much in love with this guy, swept off my feet at 15 years old," end quote. Be that as it may, he was a grown adult, and she was a child who, let's be clear, he'd raped. And then, in an incredibly twisted and bizarre turn of events, once Dawn's single father took off, leaving Dawn on her own, Holmes' wife Sharon took Dawn in, knowing full well her husband was sleeping with her. Holmes, it should not surprise you to hear, got Dawn addicted to drugs, prostituted her out, and then abused her emotionally and physically for sleeping with men he'd pimped her out to. Despite his possessiveness, however, for Christmas of 1980, Holmes sold Dawn to his drug dealer, Adel Gharib Nasrallah, or Eddie Nash. I guess it was a temporary sale, more of a loan, really, because Dawn returned to Holmes, at which point he beat her so badly, according to Crime Library, her tooth pierced her lip. Dawn then made her way to relative safety with her mother in Oregon, but Holmes pursued her relentlessly until she finally agreed to come back to him, whereupon he promised he had to do just one last deal that would finally get them out of the drugs and violence. And because Dawn was a literal child and the victim of a manipulative and charming abuser, she believed him. But by 1981, Holmes was deep in his notoriously expensive cocaine habit, which I would imagine made him even more of a shithead to be around than he was before, but also meant his money-making member was no longer membering as it was supposed to. This is about the time he made the apparently aptly titled biopic Exhausted. And so he wasn't getting the gigs he had been, and he resorted to breaking into cars and committing various petty thefts for drug money. And his drugs, at this point, were supplied by Nash, a Palestinian man whose family had been driven out of Palestine at the creation of Israel. Nash had started out selling hot dogs from a cart outside of a popular Los Angeles nightclub, and within a few years, he owned the nightclub. I don't know how exactly that happened. I don't even know vaguely how it happened. But by the early 80s, Nash owned a whole bunch of nightclubs and was the party king of the city, complete with providing drugs to seemingly half the population of LA, including a seedy bunch of folks who called 8763 Wonderland Avenue their home. In 2003, several people who'd be tangentially involved in this whole saga consulted on the movie Wonderland, directed by James Cox. It's not the greatest movie, but it's informative. Wonderland picks up after Holmes' porn career had fizzled out, and once he'd gotten himself inextricably enmeshed with a cast of unsavory characters in an unending quest for drugs. And this brings us right up to the main event of Holmes' not-so-wonderful story. In his dealings with his dealer, Holmes had made himself indispensable to Nash, providing him entry to the porn industry and its endless supply of women and customers. In return, Nash provided Holmes with a seemingly endless supply of drugs. Meanwhile, Holmes had made it into the outer edges of a circle of folks whose only purpose, at this point in their lives it seems, was to do drugs. They all lived in a large apartment at 8763 Wonderland Avenue, leased by one Joy Audrey Miller, a 46-year-old mother of two, who for some reason is never mentioned without the fact that she had both breasts removed during a bout of breast cancer. I have no idea why this is an important fact. It literally has nothing to do with anything, but anytime she's mentioned in the reporting of this story, there it is. Joy, along with every other member of her little posse, Billy Deverell, Ronald Lanius, and David Lind, all had criminal records longer than John Holmes Kilbasa, mostly having to do with drugs. Lind was also apparently something of a bounty hunter. According to Crime Library, quote, "The house was an always open for business mega pharmacy selling coke, heroin, uppers, and downers to anyone who knew the address," end quote. Holmes acted as the gang's delivery boy. In his posthumously published autobiography, put together and finalized by Lori Holmes, who married John in 1987, more on that later, Holmes wrote, quote, "My new best friends saw to it that my pockets were never empty. I became their star delivery boy, a drug runner making clandestine calls to some of Hollywood's most famous addresses, showing up at bigwigs' houses with a pound of cocaine and 100 bass pipes for his celebrity guests wasn't unusual," end quote. The Wonderland gang also dealt in stolen valuables, which Holmes would ferret to Nash's house to sell and trade. In his autobiography, Holmes claimed, quote, "For my efforts, I was paid in nugget-sized rocks of bass worth $1,000. The trouble was, I had to earn that much every day just to sustain my own habit. Not that I was irrevocably hooked, I never believed that for an instant. Nor was I overly concerned about my expenses. By comparison, the $2,000 that Joy, Billy, and Ronnie each shot away daily made me look small time. We weren't even close to being in the same league," end quote. I mean, if you have a $1,000 a day base habit, I'm not sure you're in a position to judge other people's habits. It's all relative, buddy. Anyway, the catalyst for what happened next has never been clarified. At some point, according to Holmes' account in his book, Billy Deverell decided to sell some jewelry and antique guns to Nash using their gopher, Holmes. Nash was uncomfortable with the items for some reason. He didn't think he could sell them safely or something. Who knows? These people were so drug-addled at this point, trying to make sense of their logic is pointless. Anyway, Holmes wrote that Nash said, quote, "I'll hold the guns and jewelry for 7 days in exchange for an advance of $1,000. You can take the money and get the heroin from somebody else to hold your friends over." $1,000, I said, stunned. He was offering nothing. Or at least next to nothing. The Wonderland people could shoot up a grand of heroin in a few hours. "The merchandise is worth much more than that," I argued. "You said it yourself," end quote. Holmes ultimately accepted the deal, much to the consternation of the folks back on Wonderland Avenue. And when 7 days turned into 2 weeks without getting their stuff back, and with their heroin supply gone, the Wonderland gang got itchy and began plotting how to get it all back from Nash, and maybe a little extra, too. Now, at least in the Wonderland movie, Nash was depicted not as someone you could just nicely ask for your stuff back from. Allegedly, he'd been known to kill anyone who crossed him and bury them out in the desert or the oil fields of Torrance. But the thing about drugs is they tend to lead to poor decision-making. So even though the team at Wonderland Avenue had to know how dangerous Nash was, they gassed each other up into believing robbing the notorious nightclub king and drug dealer was a good idea. A plan was hatched for Holmes to leave Nash's door open upon his next visit. Once this was done, on June 29, 1981, Billy and Ronald, dressed as cops, burst into Nash's lavish home, managed to overpower Nash's 300-pound bodyguard, Gregory DeWitt Dials, tie the men up, and force Nash, at gunpoint, to cough up the code to his safe. According to Holmes' autobiography and the Wonderland movie from 2003, one of the Wonderland guys accidentally shot Dials, who survived. The pair made off with about $1.2 million worth of cash, jewelry, and drugs. Nash immediately suspected Holmes had been in on it. One story goes that someone saw Holmes wearing a piece of Nash's jewelry the next day and reported it back to Nash. That, coupled with the fact that apparently very few people were intimately aware of the layout of his sprawling home or where he kept his safe. And then, for some reason, probably the drugs, Holmes thought it would be a good idea to call Nash. He wrote in his autobiography, quote, "Suddenly I felt compelled to talk with Nash, to let him know that despite what happened, I tried to keep him from getting hurt. Above all, I didn't want him blaming me or coming after me. In the past, whenever Nash had problems with anyone, he'd ask me to grab a piece and come help him save his life. Now, there was no mention of trouble. Everything's fine," he said lightly. "Come on up." End quote. Holmes knew everything wasn't fine, and he knew that Nash knew that he knew. And Nash must have known that Holmes knew that he knew that he knew. But despite all the knowing, Holmes went ahead and dropped by Nash's house, whereupon he was immediately pistol-whipped and had his wrists taped up. Holmes claimed he was held for 18 hours under constant watch, with Nash apparently inviting everyone he knew to come gaze upon his captor and presumably his captor's famous fire pole. Now, according to Holmes' account, eventually Nash gave him a gun and instructed him to go back to Wonderland Avenue, kill everyone in the house, get his stuff back, and as proof that they were all dead, he said, "Scoop out their eyeballs, put them in a bag, and bring them back to Nash." After some hemming and hawing, Holmes went back to Wonderland Avenue, he claimed, escorted by some of Nash's bodyguards. Once he arrived, he could immediately tell something wasn't right. The house was eerily quiet, and the smell was awful. He then claimed he found Ronald Lanius, William Deverell, Barbara Richardson, a friend visiting at the time, and Joy Audrey Miller dead, apparently bludgeoned to death where they slept. He wrote, quote, "A crazy person had to have done this. A non-human. Someone consumed with unrelenting anger. The room was filled with anger. And blood. A vampire could have gorged for days on the drippings." End quote. I'm not going to go further into the details of the murders. They were incredibly brutal and over the top. One line in the Wonderland movie mentions that they had to scrape pieces of bodies off the walls, floors, and carpets. I'll leave it there for you to imagine the rest. At this point, I suppose you're wondering, did anyone live to tell the tale of this bloodbath? Well, Ronald's ex-wife, who'd been visiting Wonderland Avenue, was also beaten mercilessly, yet somehow survived the attacks. She, however, claimed to remember absolutely nothing but shadows of the brutal attack. Neighbors would later tell police that there was always chaos happening over at 8763 Wonderland Avenue. Parties, fights, screaming. According to a piece in the LA Times from 1991, quote, "A neighbor was awakened by screams, looked out the window, and saw lights on in the house. Instead of calling police, she turned on her television set to drown out the noise." "Who knows who's been on primal scream therapy or tripping on some drug," another neighbor later said. End quote. Not present at the house during the murders was Wonderland gang member David Lind, who Holmes referred to as Killer Carl in his autobiography. He wrote, quote, "All signs pointed to Nash, until I began to think about Killer Carl. He was supposed to have gone to Pasadena with his girlfriend, Susan Lanius. Susan was the only survivor. I never saw Susan while rummaging through the house. Killer Carl knew the house was loaded with cash and cocaine. He'd kill anyone to get a gram of coke, and there were bags of it at Wonderland. He could have taken all the loot for himself and split. Whoever did this made damn sure people were dead." End quote. I don't know if Lind, aka Killer Carl, and Susan were dating. It seems unlikely, given she was the ex-wife of Ronald Lanius, though maybe partners were passed around freely at Wonderland. According to other sources, Lind was out visiting a sex worker when the murders happened. In the aftermath, Holmes also cast suspicion on another drug kingpin he called Sam, but I don't know who that might have been. According to Crime Library, quote, it wasn't until that afternoon, nearly 12 hours after the attack, that a professional mover who was working next door heard moans coming from 8763 and noticed the unrelenting barking of the pit bulls. He found the door ajar and walked into the living room where he stumbled across Richardson's body on the sofa, end quote. And despite Holmes' claim that he was not there when the murders occurred and his desperate attempt to point fingers elsewhere, not only did his story change with time, his bloody handprint was found above one of the victims. According to the Los Angeles Times, his was the only suspicious print found at the scene, which is hard to believe, but here we are. And one aspect of his story remained consistent. Both Holmes and his estranged wife, Sharon, said that he showed up at her house sometime after the murders, absolutely covered in blood, claiming to have been in an accident. Sharon, being a nurse, took out her first aid kit and tried to administer aid to Holmes as he sat crying in a hot bath, scrubbing himself and muttering. As Sharon looked for the source of all the blood, she could find no wound. When she asked where he was cut, he confessed that he knew what happened at Wonderland and that it was all his fault because he'd left the door open. So, already, cracks were appearing in Holmes' story. First, he said he went with the bodyguards to retrieve the stolen goods, and now he was saying he actively left the door open for the murderers. Although, to be fair, he may have been talking about Nash's door, for indeed, had he not helped facilitate the robbery at Nash's, the folks at Wonderland likely wouldn't have been killed. But also, if he really only found the bodies after they'd been murdered, he shouldn't have been as covered in blood as he was. It's not as if he picked up his friends' bodies and cradled them. If you recall his haunting quote describing the scene as a vampire's feast and the work of a non-human, it's worth considering. Had he dissociated? For Holmes to have been covered in the amount of blood Sharon claims he was, he would have had to have been present when the blood was being spilled. Sharon was equally dubious of Holmes' story and pushed him for the truth, at which point he confessed to her that he was present at the Wonderland home when the murders happened. But he was only there against his will, held at gunpoint, forced to watch. Dawn would later report the same to authorities. Sharon did not believe this version either. But this is the version Holmes cops to in his autobiography. Holmes told Sharon that Nash had stolen his address book and was threatening to kill everyone he knew and loved, including Sharon, if he talked. According to the Wonderland movie, police interviewed David Lind, who insisted that the entire plan for the break-in at Nash's was Holmes' idea. He convinced them to do it, drew them a map of the home, including where Nash's safe was hidden, and offered to leave Nash's door unlocked. With that information, Holmes' palm print at the scene of the murders as evidence, as well as common sense, police arrested Holmes 9 days later at a motel he was holed up in with his teenage girlfriend, Dawn. I guess, however, they didn't have enough evidence to hold him, so upon being let go, he took Dawn and the pair fled to Miami, where they tried to lay low. According to Crime Library, quote, in Miami, they checked into a flop house. Holmes worked in construction until he had problems cashing his checks under the alias he was using, Schiller told Crime Library. After he grew violent and started pimping her on Miami Beach, she worked up the courage to slip from his grasp and notify the police, end quote. In December of 1981, Holmes was formally charged with the murders and his trial began in March 1982. This trial was the first in which police video of the crime scene was used as evidence. Jurors watched the grainy footage of the carnage, blood trails from one room to the next, and blood spatter simply everywhere. They were also shown close-ups of the victim's skulls to see the impressions of the threads from the lead pipes used as bludgeons. LA Police Detective Frank Tomlinson testified that Holmes told him that Nash had forced Holmes to tell him who'd robbed him and that if he ever talked to police, Nash would kill someone in his family. He said Holmes told him the version he eventually told both Sharon and Dawn, that he'd been present, but that he did not participate. It's important to remember that by this point, Holmes had made friendships within the LAPD, most especially in the Vice Squad, to whom he was providing information on the porn industry. I believe Frank Tomlinson's character was turned into Vice Detective Billy Ward in the movie, played by MC Gaines, and it was implied that his long-standing friendship with Holmes made it difficult for him to remain objective. Holmes' lawyers portrayed him as a victim, an innocent pawn in a game being played by dangerous and powerful people. The jury, it seems, bought this defense, and on June 26, 1982, Holmes was acquitted. After the trial, Holmes was ordered to testify in front of a grand jury about the murders. Fearing Nash's wrath, Holmes refused and spent 110 days in jail for contempt of court. It was here he began working on his autobiography that I've been quoting throughout this episode. Meanwhile, police were still trying to nab Nash, raiding his home three times and seizing $1 million worth of cocaine. Nash's lawyers were like, no, see, he's not a drug dealer. This cocaine is for his own personal use. LOL. Nash was subsequently sentenced to 8 years for possession. With Nash behind bars, Holmes finally felt safe enough to answer some of the court's questions in exchange for his own freedom. With his freedom, Holmes tried to get back into the porn movie business, but his reputation was tainted and, I dare say, his love wand was likely limp. And then, in 1985, John Holmes was diagnosed with HIV. And though there was all kinds of confusion and stigma around the virus, indeed Reagan willfully ignored it for 4 years as thousands upon thousands of people died, it was by then well known, especially to those in the professional sex trade, to be spread by sex and a death sentence. Despite this, even after his diagnosis, Holmes continued to have sex with people. He even made a couple more movies, despite knowing he was infectious. But in his book, he reasoned, quote, I would be working mostly with my same circle of people from the San Fernando Valley. Maybe I wasn't thinking clearly, but I figured if they didn't get AIDS from me, it was likely they would get AIDS from someone else in the business, end quote. Maybe give them the opportunity to decide for themselves if/who they want to get AIDS from? Who knows how many people he helped get infected? Yikes, dude. Holmes married his second wife, another porn actress, in January of 1988, and then died just 2 months later on March 31st at a VA hospital. In April of that year, the LA Times printed an article that included interviews with both Sharon and Dawn, and Sharon's official statement about Holmes' second confession to her that he was forced to watch the murders at gunpoint. I guess she hadn't testified against him at trial because she was still his wife? I don't know. You'd think she would have wanted to take him down by then. Dawn told the LA Times, quote, John was so much of a liar, he didn't know what the truth was anymore, about himself, about anything, end quote. Sharon added, quote, he went out of his life denying, saying I had no involvement, end quote, to which Dawn clarified, quote, it's a lie, end quote. Meanwhile, Nash, who had only served 2 of his 8-year sentence before being released, found himself once again in the hot seat when, about 6 months after Holmes' death, Scott Thorson, a former lover of Liberace, whom Crime Library described as a, quote, cocaine enthusiast, came forward with new evidence against Nash for the Wonderland murders. According to Crime Library, quote, at the preliminary hearing for Nash and Dials last year, Thorson, 32, author of Behind the Candelabra, My Life with Liberace, and then in jail awaiting trial on charges of receiving stolen property, testified that he frequently bought cocaine at Nash's house. Thorson said he heard Nash vow to have those people on their knees for having robbed him of $1 million in drugs, money, and jewelry. He said Nash threatened Holmes, whom he suspected of being an accomplice in the theft, and banged him against a wall, demanding the identities of the robbers, and instructed Dials and Holmes to retrieve the stolen goods, end quote. However, he also said he heard Nash express some remorse, saying, quote, he felt he was responsible for sending Mr. Holmes and Mr. Dials there, and it had all turned into a bloody mess. He felt the whole thing had gotten out of hand, end quote. I mean, out of hand is one way to put it, I suppose. Though Nash and his bodyguard Dials were tried separately, their proceedings happened concurrently in the same courtroom to save everyone time. Because honestly, when it comes to the brutal murder of four people and the permanent maiming of another, who can be bothered to go to two separate trials? According to the Los Angeles Times, David Lind was brought in as a witness for the prosecution. On the stand, he said, quote, the certain type of dope dealer you didn't rob was Mr. Nasrallah. It was obvious from the time we got in the house that we were in over our heads. Lind said that he and the other two men who did the actual robbery cheated Holmes, who planned it, and McCourt, the driver of the getaway car, out of their fair share of the loot, end quote. Lind also admitted that his memory of the events of 9 years earlier were hazy with time and drug use. The defense team seized on this and argued that Lind and Thorson, the cocaine enthusiast, were unreliable witnesses. According to Crime Library, defense attorney Richard Lasting, quote, dismissed his testimony, calling Thorson an opportunistic liar. He blamed the killings on a falling out among thieves, implying that Holmes or someone else involved in the Nash break-in massacred the Wonderland residents when they didn't get their share of the loot, end quote. The LA Times reported that, quote, defense attorneys claim such witnesses, drug users with criminal records, are unreliable and that they received special treatment from authorities in exchange for their testimony, end quote. Defense attorney Edward Rucker said, quote, it is difficult to capture the dark hues of that kind of a world, populated by desperate people, a world devoid of the type of value system that you know and that you operate on, end quote. Once again, it seems, this you-can't-trust-these-witnesses defense worked. Nash was acquitted when one juror refused to vote guilty. Dials also won his freedom, with his jurors voting 10-2. But the state wasn't finished going after Nash for the Wonderland murders, and in 1991, he was put on trial again. This time, defense attorneys did their best to raise suspicion on other people. People who, frankly, hadn't been under suspicion for these murders ever before, as far as I know. Specifically, a man named Paul Kelly, who, according to the LA Times, the defense argued had been ordered to kill the Wonderland folks by a man who went by Fat Howard Cook. Cook, the defense claimed, quote, was owed money for drugs, sent Paul Kelly and other men to the house. Evidence against Kelly included a taped interview that police conducted with his girlfriend Maggie Kaufman days after the murders, end quote. Kaufman told police Kelly had promised to marry her, but first he would have to, quote, eliminate a few people that you care about, right? End quote. One of those people, allegedly, was Ronald Lanius. Once again, Nash and Dials were acquitted. Needless to say, the LAPD and prosecutor's office were fuming. They continued to dog Nash and perform the occasional raid. In one such raid, in September of 95, police found what they thought would bury Nash, a white ball of crystal meth. And while these guys were perp-walking Nash for the drugs, the lab came back and was like, guys, this is actually just a mothball. L-O-L. I cannot begin to tell you how hard I guffawed at this when I read it. I love the idea of a police officer being like, I got you, bub. You're gonna do hard time for this one. And it's just a fucking mothball. But, you know, you throw enough darts at the wall and eventually you'll hit something. And so, in May of 2000, Nash was once again arrested, this time on federal charges including narcotics trafficking, money laundering, bribery, and racketeering. The indictment also included conspiracy charges related to the murders and named the now-dead Holmes, along with four other individuals, as being co-conspirators. Nash was 71 by this point. Dials had died a couple years earlier. Nash was in poor health, having tested positive for TB, which for someone of his age is a toss of the dice in terms of lethality. Both the U.S. Attorney's Office and Nash's lawyer were concerned he would not survive the trial. According to a piece on Salon.com from 2000, Nash's lawyer, Bradley Brennan, was quoted saying, quote, "He's in bad shape. He's got emphysema and has had part of his lung removed. They've got him in horrible, almost medieval conditions. Could it kill him? I'm not a doctor. I don't know. But it's not going to do him any good," end quote. According to Crime Library, quote, "During a routine court appearance on racketeering charges, the 72-year-old playboy, suffering from emphysema and tuberculosis, told the court that yes, he had indeed conspired to commit the Wonderland murders. He also admitted to bribing the holdout juror in his 1991 trial. As soon as he sat back, his defense attorney jumped up. The record should be clear that the defendant is not admitting and in fact denies involvement in committing those murders," end quote. I mean, he literally did just admit to his involvement. But the prosecution apparently had an audio tape of Nash bragging to an informant that he'd bribed the juror who'd refused to find him guilty. With that, they argued he'd basically admitted to being guilty, which I think is debatable. Not that he was guilty, just that him saying he bribed a juror meant that he was guilty. To be clear, I think he was guilty. At any rate, with everyone thinking Nash was at death's door, he took a plea deal of 37 months in prison. According to a piece on All That's Interesting, quote, "He was offered a plea deal in 2001 and served only 1 year in prison. In the end, Eddie Nash admitted to ordering his men to retrieve his belongings from the Wonderland gang," end quote. However, Nash never admitted to ordering the murders or having any prior knowledge of them. And then, after taking the plea deal and ultimately only serving 1 year, Eddie Nash lived another 14 years as a free man. And so, to this day, we can't confirm the actual truth about how the Wonderland murders came to be or who actually committed them. The truth died decades ago as each player died off or disappeared. But there is plenty of anecdotal evidence about their lives and entanglements for you to take a stab at filling in the blank yourself, dear listener. Sharon and Don maintain they believe Holmes actively participated in the murders, and frankly, they are the two who knew him best. They knew the violence he was capable of and the depths of his addiction. As for a motive, Holmes was not in Nash's good graces at the time of the murder, and Nash admitted to ordering his men to retrieve his lot from Holmes' Wonderland gang. Blood was on the walls, but how it specifically got there is a drug-fueled blur. And if anything, stranger, may this story serve as a cautionary one about the dangers of combining drug addiction with career ambition. When caught up in an industry where it's normal and even framed as part of the work to get high, it's easy to lose yourself, your wits, and maybe even your mind on the way to the top. Addiction is a disease that has been and still is normalized in so many contexts. So normalized, we forgot the harm it can cause, not only to ourselves and others, but also memory, stories, and our very conception of the truth. And if you or a loved one is struggling with substance abuse, know that there are plenty of places to call for information, help, or just a listening ear. You can find yourself on the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services National Hotline by dialing 1-800-662-4357. That's 1-800-662-4357. Stay safe, stranger. Next time on Strange and Unexplained. Way back in 1903, residents of Van Meter, Iowa, reported seeing a strange creature with a light-up horn on its head, leaping from rooftop to rooftop. Legend of the Van Meter Visitor lives on to this day. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. Special thanks to Grab Bag executive producer-level member Richard Nacy, This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Gordet, editorial help from Becca D. Gregorio, and sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you'd like to support the show, please consider becoming a member of Grab Bag Collab. We have built an incredible community of listeners who support a small, profit-sharing, woman and non-binary-owned business. At GrabBag, we're committed to giving a platform to voices who might otherwise get overlooked by bigger networks. Plus, all our contributors get to keep ownership of their content. It's a whole new approach to podcasting. Come check it out at grabbagcollab.com. For just $4 a month or $40 a year, you can get Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. And for just $8 or $80 a year, you'll get all the shows GrabBag has to offer, including my other shows, Dear Daisy and Shut the F Up, Nick Lachey, as well as Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries, The Catalyst, Tales of the Resistance, What If They're Wrong, and all of our quarterly shows. You can even sign up to join our live recordings. We have book clubs, live hangs, watch parties, and more. If you're feeling extra generous, you can sign up at the $50 level for even more perks, including all our shows and extras, and have your name read in the credits of our shows. Head to grabbagcollab.com today to join. To suggest an episode for Strange and Unexplained, you can email me directly at contact@strangeandunexplainedpod.com or go to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. You can follow me on Instagram at SNUPod or Daisy Egan and join the Facebook page to be a part of the conversation. Thanks so much for listening, and stay strange.